And in some ways, I'm much more moved by people's actions than their beliefs. I have a lot of people, friends, who share my beliefs and do things that I find appalling. And there are others who have absolutely opposite beliefs from mine, who do things that are really heroic and moving to me. So, in some ways, it is what we do with our life rather than what we think about it that is interesting to me.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today, Pico Iyer comes back on the show to talk about his new book, Aflame, Learning from Silence. If you listen to this podcast or read my books before, you'll know that Pico is one of my travel writing heroes. I quote him more than a dozen times in my latest book, The Vagabond's Way, which is more than any other writer or thinker. I've actually been friendly with Pico for more than 20 years now, and for the past few years, my wife Kiki has got to know him as well. So Kiki joins us for this interview, and in fact, she makes some of the most compelling points and asks some of the most intriguing questions, in part because, like Pico, she's a big fan of the American monk and mystic Thomas Merton, who's written some of her favorite books. As you might guess from its title, Pico's new book is not about travel, but about stillness and how more than three decades of visits to a Catholic monastery on California's Big Sur coast has been an important counterbalance to the traveling life he's famous for. Together, Pico and Kiki and I talk about how developing a relationship with silence and contemplation can deepen your life. We talk about how the way we live is more important than what we profess to believe, and how public success is only as significant as your ability to listen to the world and give back to the world and sit alone with your thoughts. We talk about how contemplative traditions span cultural lines and how Pico has deep respect for the Catholic monks he interacts with, even though he doesn't consider himself a Christian. We talk about the ecstasy that comes with longing and the joy that comes with never quite finding what you're looking for. We talk about how deeply spiritual people aren't necessarily pious and how friendships with unconventional people like Leonard Cohen and the Dalai Lama have enhanced Pico's life. I start by mispronouncing the name of Dutch Catholic theologian Henri Nouwen in the context of quoting him about silence. Let's listen in.
So Pico, before we started recording, we were talking a lot about travel because I sort of know you as a travel writer, but your new book is very much about sitting still in silence in one place. And I'm here with my wife, Kiki, and we do morning readings when we can every morning. And we've been reading Henri Nouwen recently. And there's a great Henri Nouwen quote where he says that words lose their power when they're not born out of silence. And I was just thinking that you've been a favorite travel writer of me for a long time. Reading your new book, I realized that your career as a travel writer is sort of born out of a stillness and a silence that counterbalances your travels. Is that a fair thing, or what do you make of that?
It's a fair thing, and I think that's increasingly true, maybe especially as I get older. I remember you read my first book, which was a frenzy of constant movement with no silence and no stillness for reader or writer when I was in my 20s. But you're right. I mean, you've probably noticed over the course of my life, I spent longer and longer on each book, and they get shorter and shorter and shorter, and there's more and more sort of white space on the page for the reader to fill in. So you're right. I think that's... The notion is I'm trying to throw a suggestion out so that you can be silent with it or take it somewhere entirely different. You know, I just, Henri Nouwen is a, I was spending a lot of time reading him last year, and I think of him as a kind of brother to Thomas Merton. I just the other day ran into this great sentence from Merton who said, when your mind is silent, the forest suddenly becomes magnificently real. And so in some ways, the quieter you are, the more the outside world comes to you in all its richness and immediacy. So I think even as a traveler, it's a beautiful thing to be silent, because then you're leaving yourself behind and you're opened up to the wonders of Thailand or Paris or wherever it may be. And I've been thinking a lot of late, and I'm sure you've had these same thoughts, about how, you know, when we're speaking, we're not really learning very much. And when we're listening, we're letting the whole world come to us. And so I think a traveler's basic mission is to keep quiet and to have all his senses on alert, or her senses on alert.
Yeah, one phrase I wrote down when reading your book is the geography of silence, in part because you were talking about how you sort of used it as a metaphor. If your radio is on, then you're not going to hear the ocean, right? If your life is really busy, you're not really going to see your life. And I thought, well, that is such a California metaphor, because here in Kansas, you don't hear the ocean. I mean, there's other things that you can hear. So
geese, you can hear Canada geese. I heard them on my little walk tonight. I was being quiet on the prairie. And I think your point is so well made. I do, I feel both more myself and also part of the landscape when I'm quiet and not listening to a podcast or music, when I just listen to the sounds. It's the closest thing I feel to God, I think, when I am in nature and listening.
Beautiful. I mean, you've just summarized not only my life, but my book perfectly. And I loved it. You were saying, you know, more yourself. And I would say, for me, it's equivalent to that, but it's more my best self or my deeper self. Mm. It's the self that gets lost in traffic or in chatter or when I'm racing from the bank to the pharmacy. And I sometimes think that I have a social self that I have to mm-hmm. activate when I'm talking on a podcast like this. But I have a silent self that's much deeper and more intimate and more mysterious, and probably that is what I can share with my wife and my closest friends. And that's mm-hmm. what comes out in this silence or when you're walking across the prairie. Because as Rolf was saying, you can't hear the ocean in Kansas, but there's so much else you can hear that those of us in California would envy.
To that point, can I?
Yeah, go for it.
I was looking for my copy of New Seeds of Contemplation, and I finally found it. But the reason I couldn't find it is because it's taped together.
I love it.
You can't read the, I mean, it's falling apart, but I read it over the course of, I don't know, like 4 years. It's not something you can really, you have to take your time with, but I was flipping through it knowing we were going to get a chance to talk to you. And he said, apropos of, you know, best self and where you are, he says that God speaks to me in the birds and streams, but also in the clamor of the city. And this is something that, as someone who feels really bifurcated, I've lived about equal amounts of times in London and New York and Berlin as I have on the prairie. I have a hard one with this. And I wonder how you feel about that. Do you feel like you can, and I know you've got a complex relationship to God and I'm interested in that too, but like, do you feel your best self only in these quiet places, or are you able to, have you mastered it in the clamor of the city as well?
Yeah, no, I certainly haven't mastered anything, but you're right. I think that the goal is to retrieve that in the middle of the clamor. Because as you said, you know, Thomas Merton had his great epiphany in Louisville on the 4th and Walnut, intersection of Walnut. And as you know, I spent 50 years regularly talking and traveling with the Dalai Lama.
Yeah.
And I always think that the beauty and blessing of his example and his life is he's never been on top of a mountain or sequestered in a monastery. He's always on Fifth Avenue or in the White House or in the European Parliament or in the streets of Calcutta, where he's really most needed. And and anyone who's seen the Dalai Lama or his friend Archbishop Desmond Tutu can see that those men have a sense of joy and calm and light in the middle of absolute confusion and chaos. I wouldn't aspire to that, but every time I step into silence, as you know, it's been more than 100 times I've been on retreat for 33 years, it's like recovering something that's lost within me, being reminded that it exists and being reminded that something real exists beyond my day-to-day life. And then when I go back into the day-to-day life, I'm quickly distracted and fraught and conducting arguments as usual, but I've still got that memory and that prospect of this other, deeper backstage, as it were, world. And I think cumulatively over half a lifetime now, it probably has made me a little less caught up in the excitement and drama of this moment and a little better able to see things in a larger picture. That's the hope anyway. So, and you're absolutely right. I noticed very quickly when I began going there, if I spent 3 days in this undistracted quiet, because there's no cell phone reception or internet or TV there, when I came back home, I would be walking on air for about a day, and then I'd be fretting over my invoices and worried about my tax return and caught up in rush hour traffic again. But nonetheless, I think it did leave some residue, you know, the way travel does. You know, we were just talking about if you go to Thailand and then come back to your life in Kansas, there's still something of what you've seen and experienced in Thailand that will always be with you and will transform your life in Kansas. And in many cases, for the better. And so this is just an equivalent to some of the other geographical locations that have transformed me.
Mm.
What you just said reminded me of a couple of things. One is you had a great observation about how after your very busy life, you came home once and you saw the newsletter from the monastery and had these very simple requests for things like pots and pans.
Yeah.
And it really took you back to this, the very, really, actually it reminded me of Peter Matheson's line in the Snow Leopard about how when he, life is so simple when you're in the mountains that when you hold this teacup in your hand, that's all you do. So that really reminded me of that. And then also I think you had a quote in the book about basically it's easy to be silent in the Zen monastery. The secret is to bring that silence into the world with you.
Just exactly, I think, what Kiki was saying. And yeah, I think, Rolf, you and I both love the Snow Leopard. And I was once lucky enough to spend some time with Peter Matheson to write an article about him. And he was 65 at the time. And I remember his saying to me, my whole life has just been involved in one enterprise. Simplify, simplify, simplify. Mm. I want to make myself and my life as simple as possible. And he felt that he hadn't yet managed to do it, but that was always the aim. So I think his goal coming back from the Himalayas would be to try to make his life, even in New York state, as simple as what he'd experienced up there. But you're absolutely right. And the newsletter I got from the monastery was right after I'd come back from the Olympic Games and the cruise of 170 TV nations, constant, exciting, invigorating clamor for 3 weeks. But then to go home and face this pile of letters, mostly demands and requests and unwanted intrusions. And then this letter, please, we need pots and pans. And there's a sweetness and innocence about those monks that, again, I hope helps me recover something that might otherwise get lost in myself. Usually when they send their newsletters, they'll say something like, we just celebrated Brother Michael's 80th birthday and we had cheesecake and orange juice. And just that notion is instantly taking me to another world that I don't encounter often enough in my day-to-day life. Mm.
There is a childlikeness to it, isn't there? In the best of senses, that, you know, ameliorated all of your fears with a cup of grape juice or whatever, you know, and a nap time.
Yes, yes.
Really
beautiful. You're absolutely right. And as you're saying that, I suddenly remember, I haven't mentioned this before, but to anyone, that in the book, I got to know one of the monks very closely, and he would come down to my little room and he would share his doubts and fears and frustrations because it's a very, very hard life. And we would share tea and cookies. And then one day, the day after I'd met him, I came back to my little trailer and there was a card left there, and it was Piglet talking to Winnie the Pooh, saying, there, it'll be okay. So just as you said, a version of grape juice and I was just, you know, earlier this morning, I'm preparing to interview Richard Powers, the great novelist from the Midwest. And I was thinking his great skill, even though he's the same age as I am, is to sustain that sense of wonder and that childlike way of looking at the world, just as you were saying, Kiki. I mean, he's probably the most brilliant novelist in America, and yet he's never lost hold of that ability to look up at the stars or look down at the ocean. Mm. Oh, this is beyond anything I could have dreamed of seeing.
Yeah, I think there's that balance where we're sort of trained out of our childhood to live practical, productive lives, but then sometimes it's easy to forget what we've lost of that childhood. And sometimes maybe being around children or around monks. One thing I love about travel is being around kids with whom I don't share the language, and they're the least self-conscious because they don't care. They don't want to have an intellectual conversation. They just want to run around and have fun with this strange looking guy from the other side of the world. So
yes, yes. And I think one of my first surprises at hanging around with the monks is they don't want to have intellectual conversations either. They want to run around and enjoy themselves with their visitors. And, you know, they're watching Monty Python movies in their rec room on Sunday nights. And they're most down-to-earth souls I could ever meet. And also, as with Thomas Merton, the least dogmatic. They're much less dogmatic than I and my friends are. Mm-hmm. So going there, one of the beauties of being there was cutting through my preconceptions and notions I had about monastics. As you know, Rolf, that's the beauty of any kind of travel. We have certain ideas about what Iran is or North Korea or Thailand. And then as soon as we go there, there's a human reality far wider than our ideas.
I want to bogart this entire conversation.
You're a good interviewer, Kiki. Keep going for it.
Please.
As the last time when we had lunch with Pico, I just, we were so excited because it's an honor for one thing to be with someone who's such a great mind, but also you're so kind because you're like, yes, that's a great point. And I actually feel elevated to your level. So I thank you. But I want to talk to you about fire because it's obviously metaphorical, but also very, very literal in your life. And I think anyone who's read your books know that that was a really, I don't know, dare I say baptism for you, or a real like BC AD moment for you.
And just so my listeners know, you lost a house and all of your work in California years ago. So just so my listeners know.
All of your belongings. And you quote one of the desert fathers who, and I looked it up to try to find out which desert father it was, but I think it's been lost to the annals of history. But the quote is, if you so wish, you can become a flame, which I'm guessing, you know, you took that from for your title. But what does that mean? I just came across this in your book and I don't know what it means. And I want to know what it means for you insofar as you're willing to share with virtual strangers.
Oh, I'm very happy to share what little I know. And that was partly inspired by the scene at the end of Thomas Merton's Sign of Jonas, which you probably know, Kiki.
I don't know it actually.
Oh, somebody told me a million years ago, read the last 40 pages of The Sign of Jonas, and that's the best you'll ever get of Thomas Merton.
I
think you might be right.
Okay. So
it ends with this section called Firewatch. So he's walking alone through his monastery at night on a hot summer day, July the 3rd, I think, with a flashlight, trying to ensure that there are no embers or sparks, because one tiny spark can set alight that entire old wooden building and destroy their lives, essentially.
Mm.
And so he's padding alone through the dark, trying to protect the monastery from fire, while remembering that his only duty as a human, as a monk, is to keep the fires alive within himself and to make sure that he's indeed a flame. Because I think he's the one who rendered that story about the desert father saying, if you want to be, you can be fully a flame. And I think in some way or other, we all know versions of that. You know, I was just reading in Jung, that Carl Jung said the difference between a good life and a bad life is how you walk through the fire. And at some level, you know, we all face so many metaphorical, if not literal, fires in our life. And in California, of course, what we're learning is that you need fire. And the hills need fire as a regenerative influence to thin the overgrowth and to make things continue to flourish. So we can't live without it, but how are we going to live with it, given that it's imperiling our lives all the time? And it's interesting how, you know, forest fires, for example, are called acts of God. And then you have to think about how do monks live with these fearsome acts of God that are devastating everything that they know and love. There was one moment, and again, you will have seen it because it's in the book, when, as you said, I lost my home and everything in it and my next three books and everything except the clothes I was wearing in a forest fire a long time ago. And then we rebuilt the house in the same property because that's what insurance policies pretty much request. And we've had to evacuate that new house again and again. So there was one time a few years ago when we had to flee our new house and we were staying downtown Santa Barbara, not knowing if we'd have a home to go back to. And at the very same moment, my monk friends in Big Sur, California, were running out of their monastery, fleeing another fire 3.5 hours up the coast. And I woke up one morning and I didn't know whether I wanted to look up to the hills where our house usually is, or whether I didn't want to look up there because there might be just an empty space where our house was meant to be. And I didn't know what to do because I'm just waiting and waiting and waiting to see if I have a home ever to go back to. And then I remembered that there's a beautiful monastery in our hometown at the top of another mountain. So I drove up there and I went and I sat in the garden. And again, the silence there is very clarifying. It's a positive presence, not just absence of noise. And I looked out over the Pacific Ocean and I saw a plane flying across in order to try and douse the fire on the other side of town. I really, really felt absolutely calm, and it gave me just the medicine I needed. And later that year, that monastery where I'd sought refuge, it was burned to the ground. And in fact, the monks there had to run away, and to this day they have no home. So nowhere is really safe, and literally, but again, as I say, figuratively too. And I think we all have this sense more and more, we're living in a world on fire. And what do we do with that?
I think that there can be a kind of wisdom of fire in this landscape. The grasslands have been cultivated by fire for centuries, and we actually do it here, but it's actually more dangerous on our little 30 acres to not do controlled burns than it is to let these other invasive plants, and especially the cedars. Actually, our Christmas tree, you can't quite see it, Pico, behind us is an eastern red cedar, but if our land overgrew with that, it would be a very dangerous place in terms of fire. And so our land becomes much more beautiful when it is thoughtfully tended by fire.
Well, even the notion of it being a controlled burn is kind of funny. I don't know how well we're controlling it. We've done it twice. We've taken part in a controlled burn twice. I have. And it got out of control the next day, and the volunteer fire department had to come out, and they were none too happy.
Really?
Yeah.
But I love that, because you're right. You and the land around you couldn't survive without those fires. I don't know if you ever saw, my favorite film ever, a million years ago, was called Days of Heaven. And I found out, that some of the most powerful scenes, as you remember, were a fire there, almost a biblical fire. And apparently that was out of control too. And so the scenes in the movie where you see them desperately trying to control it, it was real for them. Yeah. They were close to getting wiped out by those flames. Yeah. So controlled burns is perfect, because we can't control anything, really.
No.
Well, I think this sort of underscores how we are in, and you point this out in your book, you're in conversation with nature when you're in nature. That if you worry about the mountain lions, then you have to acknowledge that the mountain lions live there and you're visiting, right? I think going way back to the idea of being silent, turn off the radio so that you can hear the ocean. One of my favorite pieces of music, philosophically, if not listening to it, is John Cage's 4:33, which is basically the orchestra sits still for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, and the audience eventually becomes attuned to the noises that are already happening, the noises that are always happening, the sounds that we have tuned out because we're waiting for music, when in fact sometimes the earth is singing or the room is singing. You were in with a community of monks. You were there with yourself, and you talked about how you sort of felt the presence of absent friends while you were there, but you're also there in nature. So how did nature affect your experience of this time in a monastery in California?
Yeah, well, I'm so happy, before we get onto that you mentioned John Cage, because he is a mega hero of mine. And of course, he wrote the definitive book on silence. And he delivered this great line, which is similar to the Henri Nguyen line you cited at the beginning, which is, I have nothing to say and I am saying it. So even apart from 4:33, he went around basically practicing silence. And I just read yesterday a great line from him, because he was probably, I think, the great Zen writer of the 20th century. But he made a point of stressing he never meditated and he never had any formal Zen practice. But he said, I wouldn't be able to do any of the things I do without Zen. So, but he was certainly a connoisseur of silence, and reminding us what we were saying earlier, which is that if there's absolutely no music in the room, there's plenty to listen to wherever you are and any moment of the day. And you're right, in terms of that living with nature, monks and nuns, by their nature, choose to live in the remote settings and in the wilderness. And living in the wilderness is akin to the 40 days and nights in the wilderness in the Bible. In other words, it's often scary and lonely, and you're at the mercy of the elements, and there are absolutely no guarantees. And sometimes when I go to this radiant place above the Pacific Ocean that's all light and beauty, suddenly a torrential winter storm will break out, and the rain starts pounding on the roof, and the wind shakes the flimsy foundations of my little trailer, and I look out and I can't see a single light or a single sign of human habitation. And it's really terrifying and lonely, and it reminds me that it's not just an easy and fortunate thing to be out in the middle of wilderness. It brings its dangers, and really makes me respect monks and nuns who live head on, intimately, day after day, with their fears and doubts. And even more so because, climate change is a bit of a theme in this book. So 7 of the last 8 years, my monk friends in Big Sur, California, have had the road below them completely washed out, twice by forest fires, 3 times by winter storms, and twice by COVID. So that absolutely cut off from the world. And most of them are very elderly. And when they fall ill, they have to be helicoptered out to the nearest hospital, which is 2.5 hours by car away. Wow. It's very hard for them to get supplies in. It's very hard for them to survive financially because they need $3,000 a day to sustain their community, and they're getting basically zero when they're in their visitors. So they're really living on the edge. And as you remember, I say at one point in the book, you guys are the real counterculturalists. I mean, you're the radical ones daring to live on the brink of destruction and on the edge of the earth, just the way, you know, Thomas Merton used to talk about. So you're absolutely right. Living so close to nature, in my case, just now and then, but in their case, permanently, is a way of living in a state of extreme vulnerability. And as you're saying with the mountain lions, at the mercy of forces much bigger than you are, it's a real act of faith and trust on their part to be in such a difficult to reach place. The nearest post office is an hour away, even in the best of conditions.
I was just thinking how some listeners might think, oh wow, what's the liability policy on a monastery like that? Which made me think that there is sort of a consumer, like there's lots of commercial spiritual retreats. And I don't mean to knock commercial spiritual retreats because I think there's a certain idealism that drives them. But how can we balance the line between buying a spiritual experience and having a spiritual experience?
I mean, that's really wonderfully put. I'm always really conscious that I'm very lucky to be able to afford the time and money to go and take 3-day retreats or 2-week or 3-week retreats. It must be said, when I first began staying with the monks, it was right after my house had burnt down and I was sleeping on a friend's floor, and another friend saw me there and he said, come on, you can do better than this, Pico. And he told me about this hermitage 3.5 hours to the north, where at least I'd have a bed to sleep in and a big desk and a private walled garden, hot showers and food. And in those days, the donation they requested was $30 a night. So I thought, for $30 a night, it's well worth having these comforts. And now, many years later, the donation they suggest is higher because they're running out of monks and running out of revenue. And so in those days, it was almost free. But I think one of the reasons my heart goes out to these guys is they never ask for money, essentially. They're so unworldly. And then when a prior says, you know, we're not going to be able to survive unless we ask more of our guests, they still say, no, we don't want to ask more of our guests because St. Benedict has called us to hospitality. That's what we're doing for a living, opening our doors to everybody, more or less free of charge, as free of charge as we can. And as you know, I mentioned in the book, at one point, one idealistic young guy came up to them and he just inherited $3 million. And he said, I'd like to give this to you. And that would have taken care of all their financial woes for years to come. And they said, no, please don't do something so reckless. Really think about it and decide where your money will be most helpful to other people. And so I'm always touched, even during these wildfires, and people will contact the monks and say, you know, how can we best help you? And they'll say, please look after the suffering in your own community. Look after the indigent. That's the best thing that you can do. That's the way you can honor the life that we live by. So the fact that they ask for so little makes me want to give much more. And probably like you, I do know other spiritually minded organizations that are always fundraising or often asking for a lot of money. And I instinctively recoil from them. And I also recoil from spiritual communities that are either based around one charismatic figure or around some wonderful revelation that came up 10 years or 30 years ago. And I think one reason I like going to these guys is there's no figure at the center of their community. They're not asking me to follow any theology or ideology. And they've been doing this for 1,000 years. And so it's not something that was just discovered. It's a tried and tested method just for trying to live in a complicated world that has been through wars and convulsions and so much else. So I suppose the fuddy-duddy in me is drawn to these rather modest, quiet souls who are just living the way people have lived since the year 1012, which is when their congregation began.
Can I ask him a question about Christianity?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I mean, Merton's a big Jesus guy. And I'm guessing a lot of these monks are too. And you say in it that it doesn't matter if you believe in God, and a friend of yours pegged you as being slippery for demurring. Yeah. How do you square you know, and I don't want to call you what you aren't, but if you're not a Christian, I assume, how do you square and how do you reconcile that?
Yeah. So I'll say two things. And you know, I stress a lot of silence in this book because I feel silence is non-denominational and belongs to everybody. And each one of us, you know, when you were talking about walking and hearing the keys, when each one of us has those experiences of something beyond us, we each give different names to it, whether it's God or divinity or the truth or reality, whatever it is. And I think the words and the texts and the explanations are much less important than the experience. And in some ways, it's just like speaking different languages. So I'm not worried if my monk friends describe their experience and their devotion differently than I do. I think the beautiful thing is they're encouraging me and inviting me to share something of what they know. And they're not asking me to put it in biblical terms. The other thing, which you would see more maybe in the second half of the book, is that this is known as the Camaldolese order. So it's the most contemplative congregation within the whole Catholic Church. And they've actually been given a dispensation by the Vatican to interact with other traditions as much as possible in the light of Vatican II, which said anything that is true and holy in any religion we embrace and encourage. And so, for example, the prior, a recent prior of this community, who's a very close friend of mine, teaches regularly at the Zen workshop across the hills. When I go and have dinner in his little cell, there's a picture of Jesus in the lotus position. and the Camaldolese order maintains an ashram in southern India, a Catholic Hindu ashram, where the priest wears a dhoti and sleeps on the floor and eats with his hands. And when you go and stay with them, you open the little pamphlet they have in every room. On the very first page, it says, by the way, the father of monasticism was the Buddha. And then they quote the Rig Veda from Hindu philosophy. So as I say, they're much less dogmatic than I am and than most people are. And my sense always is that the deeper you are in a tradition, the more you're open to every other tradition because you're not defensively or protectively holding on to something. You know where you stand. And Merton is a perfect example. So, as you know, in the last year of Merton's life, he traveled to Asia to learn about Buddhism. And he had three meetings with the Dalai Lama. And I think what's so beautiful about those meetings is that when Thomas Merton, as you said, a Jesus guy, talks to the Dalai Lama, his understanding of Jesus and Christianity becomes much deeper. And when the Dalai Lama talks to Thomas Merton, as the Dalai Lama says to this day, his understanding of Buddhism, as well as his tolerance, becomes much greater. And so in that sense, you know, the monks are open-minded enough that they often allow me to stay with them in their cloister, you know, having lunch with them every day and basically being part of their community. And there was another person there who was studying to be a rabbi. There was another person there who was on his way to becoming an MTV executive. They're living in a world beyond divisions, I would say. And that's why, you know, communion is an important word, not necessarily in a strictly Christian sense, but where is our common ground? And I think they realize that our common ground lies in the place beyond our words and ideas often. So, a part of me feels embarrassed and guilty that I'm enjoying their hospitality while not sharing their faith. But a larger part of me is just so admiring of that kind of tolerance that they embody that I want to learn from.
I think we all could. It feels like that's the way forward for how we exist together.
Yes. And to be honest, that's why the reason why after almost 34 years of staying with them, I suddenly am bringing out a book now, because I've never seen the world as divided as we are now. And I've never seen so many of my friends as despairing as they are now. And I think a lot of the division has to do with people saying, I know better than you, or I know more than you, or basing their lives around their ideologies. And so I'm very keen to draw attention to silence and to this typical community where people are living beyond all that and with completely open doors and arms. Because as you say, I think it's something we're all craving at some level, but we don't know how to get beyond our divisions. You know, there were, at any given time, there are 15 people staying there, and I would say the majority are women, and the monks really gain a lot from feminine presence. And in fact, at any given time, there are usually two or three women actually living in the on the property outside the cloister, helping to with accounts and looking after guests and the like. And I would also say that maybe the majority of people staying there aren't Catholic. And mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of Buddhists and Sufis and nothing at all, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And again, the monks are ready to welcome everybody and confident that anybody will find what she most needs there.
Mm. There's a scene in the book where someone asks you about God and you say, God is reality. talk about that a little bit. Talk about the footprint and the lineage of that idea.
Well, yeah. I mean, the best thing I can say is that came out of me without thinking. And it was just intuition or something other than myself speaking, which is why it's much better answer than I could have come up with. So, yes, I was doing an interview with a fairly well-known interviewer in my hometown. And the producer in advance had said, well, at the end of this interview, there are going to be lots of rapid-fire questions. And you're just going to have to give very quick answers. So we'll tell you what they are in advance. So she told them she told me what they would be, and that gave me a chance to think about them. And then when I went out to the interview, at the end of the interview, these questions came out, and they were totally different from the ones I'd been prepared for. So they really caught me off guard. And then I think the first question was, what's your definition of God? So I just reality just came out of me like that.
Wow.
Without a second thought. And then later I thought, wonderful, if I'd thought and thought and thought about the answer, I'd have been a bad answer or a false answer. What came out of me was true. And again, true to what I think. And again, later I thought, well, it could mean what a Christian would say, God is real, or it could mean what a Buddhist would say, which is reality is our master that we have to bow before and live with. But it doesn't really matter, any of that. And then the host was a bit surprised. I think she said, I've asked that of 3,000 people, and I've never heard that answer before. But yeah, I'm it's one of the few things I've said I can be pleased with, and I wouldn't dispute even now.
Well, it's funny. When I read that, it's something was very resonant about that statement, but something was familiar too. So I started searching it on my laptop, and it turns out I had quoted that in my first book, Vagabonding. There's no God but reality, and then I realized really? That I'd got yes, but and so it's like certainly I didn't make that up. So where did I get it? So I dug deeper in my research, and it's from a Jim Harrison novel called The Woman Lit by Fireflies. There's no God but reality. Then I realized he attributed it to a Sufi sect called the Sarmun Brotherhood, which is about 1,000 years old, the same age as the order of monks that you stay with in California. So that was just a bit of pre-podcast detective work I did. That phrase, it's so bracing. And I think in the contemplative world, it has had some sort of resonance for a long time.
That's fantastic. You're really enlightening me there, Rolf. I mean, when you asked about lineage, you could tell I knew nothing about a lineage. It just came out of me. Now, Jim Harrison had a really serious Zen practice for a long time. That does sound like a classic Zen saying. And it's wonderful that the Sufis, and it's a kind of bears out what I was saying a minute ago, really, to Kiki, which is, you know, every tradition across the world has probably come to many of the same understandings. And although we may use different words for it, the understandings are similar. And there's an example. I don't know if a Christian might object to my saying that, but it's interesting that a Buddhist or a Sufi wouldn't.
I don't think Merton would.
No, exactly. No. Well, he was there. He wrote a book on Zen, and he was constantly working with the Sufis. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, while we're talking about Merton, something I discovered that I didn't realize until I read your book was that Merton was sort of friendly with Henry Miller and sort of approving of Henry Miller. And of course, we think of Henry Miller, you know, sort of visiting the brothels of Paris, right? But he's this figurehead in Big Sur, as is, you know, Jack Kerouac and Gary Snyder, even Don Draper in the world of fiction in the TV show Mad Men. And I looked up while I was doing my research, the monastery that you go to is also a post-war monastery. It was founded in the 50s. And so there's this real post-war energy going on at Big Sur. And so talk a little bit about that intellectual spiritual tradition that isn't necessarily a prim, it's sort of a counterculture spiritual tradition.
Well, and Leonard Cohen, nobody thinks of him as being, I mean, like before he became a monk, he was definitely a bit on the edge, right?
Mm-hmm. And maybe after becoming a monk too. Yeah. And his monastery was down in LA. But,
right, right.
But you're absolutely right, Rolf. I mean, ever since I was a kid, I've been drawn to Big Sur very powerfully. I remember soon after I got my driving license when I was 16, I just drove up there for a day and sat beside the fire at the Nepenthe restaurant.
Nepenthe!
Yeah. Oh, as you know, it's full of magical places, Big Sur. And like all charismatic places, and you've been to many across the planet, some people are really drawn there and some people are put off. But I happen to be magnetized towards it. And as you say, I mean, Hunter Thompson lived there, Joan Baez, everybody has congregated, especially, as you say, after the war. And Henry Miller went there right after traveling across Greece to write his book, The Colossus of Marousi. And I think that was a natural progression because Big Sur feels like Greece. Mm-hmm. As you know, the clock falls away, the whole larger world falls away, and you're in this vast elemental landscape with this enormous ocean, tall redwoods, high cliffs, and the human element is tiny, almost to the point of insignificance. And so I feel I'm in the company of Odysseus or the Greek gods, whatever, in that environment. And, you know, I've often stayed at the Esalen Institute, which is said to be the birthplace of the human potential movement, right there in Big Sur. It's no coincidence the human potential movement came to life there. And in fact, in my book, it was a really conscious thing that almost all the writers I quote who are delivering contemplative, you could say, spiritual truths are people like Henry Miller, who are not associated with any religion. Thoreau, Admiral Byrd, was stuck near the South Pole for 5 months, and he began sounding like a mystic. Camus, Emily Dickinson, Etty Hillesum, the Jewish woman who lost her life to the Nazis. One person after another came to these truths about something larger than us without needing to confine it to a single religion. So Miller is a perfect example. He basically became a transcendentalist when he arrived in Big Sur, and he sounds like Emerson or Whitman or Thoreau, and that's partly what Merton recognized in him. But Thomas Merton is so open-minded that he said that this guy, as you said, Rolf, who's famous for hanging around in the bordellos of Paris, actually had a basic Christian spirit that many Christians would do well to learn from. And Merton also said of Henry Miller, you lived the life that I always wanted to live and in some level did live. So both of them were so open-minded. The religious man seeing how much wisdom the secular man had acquired, and the secular man opening his mind and heart a little to something he couldn't explain or understand.
I think your book for that very reason is so prescient right now, or so needed, because I think we are standing on our hills and saying, no, I'm right and you're not right, if we don't share the same beliefs. And I think there needs to be a lot more overlap. Can we stay on Merton for another?
And can I say something just before?
Yes, Merton, please.
Which is also, I feel that there's a huge longing in us, especially in this age of acceleration or distraction. We want something wiser, deeper, larger. We don't know where to find it. And in our public lives, it's hard to find somebody we can really think there's a hero or a spokesperson for the transcendent in us, especially if we're not a participant in a single religious tradition. So I think there's this hunger all around, and none of us know quite how to satisfy it.
But you use the word longing, and actually I was thinking about that today as I was reading your book. Susan Cain has written a book called Bittersweet that I'm only at the surface of, and she talks about why some of us, myself included, love sad music, etc., why we gravitate towards that. And there is this notion of what is longing, and she talks about how all religions, all cultures have recognized that, and that it's just intrinsic in us. It's inherent in us. And that it's actually, as opposed to what I used to think it was, which was, oh, when am I going to find the right guy? I'm longing for the right man. It's more of a deeper spiritual longing that we're almost born with. And I loved that idea that it's deeper than, I still have that longing, even though I'm married to you. I mean, it's true. I still hunger for something, and I don't quite know what it is. And I think silence has something to do with it. But I also want to, sorry, no, go ahead.
Yeah, you're throwing such provocative openings at me. I have to respond to this
one
too.
Please, no.
actually, I think what you were experiencing walking along the prairies and listening to the geese is what we're
always
longing
for. Always, yes.
So I happened to read Susan's book two weeks ago.
Oh, wow. Week.
And you will, as you get further on in it, you will find that she finds the ultimate embodiment of longing in Leonard Cohen, who's a very central part of her book, as it is of my book. And in my book, in the second half of it, I meet one of the monks as I'm walking along the road, and he says, "Remember, it's the longing that is the ecstasy. It's the hunger, it's the ache, it's the."
That makes me want to cry. I mean, you're so right. Can you imagine life without longing?
Such a beautiful, yes. And then not long ago, I was talking to somebody who hadn't read this book, and he said, "Oh, you know, Pico, whenever I read you, I think of that U2 song saying, 'I still haven't found what I'm looking for.'"
Mm.
And I said, "I'm sure Bono feels as I feel. I never want to find what I'm looking for. If I did, something would die inside me." And I'm really glad permanently to have, as you said, that longing or that sense that life is going to surprise me, and that not every, you know, Merton again said, "There's more substance in silence than in the answer to any question." And I've never got great excitement from my answers, but I've got a lot of excitement from my silences. So sorry, I cut you off. No.
I think you're so right. And of course, you've already read the book that I just mentioned. Merton talks a lot of one of the things I love the most about Merton is that one of the things he said is from New Seeds of Contemplation, "For contemplation is ultimately not perfect unless it is shared." And I think he had another aha moment when he fell in love with a woman who was nursing him. And I think that there is, you also quote T.S. Eliot as saying something about how no human can be free who lives in reach of familiar habits and urgencies. And I would also say that, you know, I've got dinner to make, and we have dishes to do, and the bed to make, and a house to remodel, and all of that. So I think, I don't know if I'm asking a coherent question, but Merton couldn't just have his ecstasies in the cabin in the woods in Tennessee. I think he found it with this woman, but he ultimately let her go. And how can we find that contemplation is perfect as shared? How do we do that?
Yes. So it took me a while after beginning to stay in this place and feeling so ecstatic to realize that the ecstasy was the doorway rather than the endpoint, and it was a doorway to a deeper understanding of community and compassion and actually being with other people. And it was, in fact, spending all that time alone that made me realize I'm never alone, partly because the people around I care for are much sometimes closer to me there, and I really think about them and think about what I need to do with and for them there in a way I don't when I'm driving along the freeway. But also that every stranger I meet along the monastery road quickly feels like my closest friend, because we're joined by something much more important than our job or our hometown or where we went to college. We're joined by the longing that we share, that has brought us to the silence. And I never forget, soon after I began staying there, I had a longtime girlfriend at that time in Japan. And I went down to the payphone at the bottom of the hill under the monastery, and I called her. And it was a beautiful April day, and the hills were flooded with poppies and lupins, and there was the ocean right underneath me. And she could hear the joy in my voice. And she asked beautifully, she said, "You know, if you met another woman, it'd be no problem. I could be more excellent than her. But how can I compete with a temple?" And that so shook me up that basically a few weeks later, I moved across the world into this two-room apartment where there was two small kids and my girlfriend, now my wife. And we've lived in this apartment, you know, more than 30 years now. So being in solitude was the one place where I could realize I needed to take the leap to get married. You know, I never thought I was going to get married, and I think I might not have got married had I not gone to spend that time in silence where everything rises to the top and I see what's really important. And just as you said, you know, see as Merton did, that the point of solitude is only to have more to offer to company. And now, wonderfully, when I go to the Big Sur Hermitage, my wife comes with me, and it's not a rival.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and in fact, the monks are much happier to see her than they are. They're so welcoming to her. And the first time I took her to the service there, and as soon as the service was over, one monk after another came. They're so excited to meet her. We thought you never existed, and we've known Pico 25 years, but we've never got to meet you. And she was really, really warmed and touched by that. And we went outside, and she turned to me, and we'd known each other 30 years at that point. And she said, all this time I thought you were an only child, and I never knew you had all these brothers. And she didn't even know that's the official term for a monk is a brother.
No kidding.
Oh, Pico, you're not alone in the world. Apart from me, your wife, you've got all these old, longtime friends who care for you so much. I've written and thought a lot about Thomas Merton and the nurse, and like everybody, I have complicated feelings about it. But I'm glad he could recover that youthful passion. I mean, we were speaking about monks having a childlike quality, and I think something that had never been completed in his youth suddenly bubbled forth when he met the 20-year-old nurse who was tending to him in the hospital. My heart also always goes out to Merton's abbot, because such a difficult thing to try to contain this electric live wire he had in his community.
Well, he wanted to go to Big Sur too, but go.
Sorry, no, but just let me cap this by, or this section, with you quoting Pascal, and I love this. I never thought a sense of peace and the passion of fire could reside in the heart at the same time. I don't know that it can. Can it? Can you be peaceful and have a sense of fire in the heart at the same time? I don't know that Merton could.
And then when you were saying about missing parts of the pandemic, it's probably the best explanation of why I keep going to this hermitage, because it's almost like making a list of not to do, and not to do list of all the things I don't need to do, but I'm somehow habituated to keep doing when I'm in my regular life. And when I go there, one of the main things I do is nothing at all. And I never allow myself to do that, even if I'm on holiday, and especially when I'm on my regular life. It's the one place in my life where I allow myself not to write, and just completely to follow intuition. So every morning when I wake up, I have no plan whatsoever for any minute of the day, and I'll just let the moment call me. Oh, let me take a walk now, and let me send a postcard to Rolf now, and let me just sit in my garden watching the light on the water now. Let me take a nap. And so that's the ultimate freedom that, as I say, I don't permit myself most of the time. And I think with the pandemic, we were all in this state of acute anxiety because we didn't know how long it would last or whether it would ever end. So we weren't in the same comfortable position. But this is like the benign form of the retreat that was the pandemic.
Mm. You had a line in your book, something in the context of Wittgenstein, I think, something about how his silence, his detachment was as important as his books. Do you remember this line?
Yeah, maybe his silence and his actions were as important as his books. And it goes back to Kiki's question about whether I feel embarrassed to stay with a group of heroic souls whose belief I don't share. And in some ways, I'm much more moved by people's actions than their beliefs. I have a lot of friends who share my beliefs and do things that I find appalling. And there are others who have absolutely opposite beliefs from mine, who do things that are really heroic and moving to me. So in some ways, it is what we do with our life rather than what we think about it that is interesting to me. And, Wittgenstein, probably one of the most brilliant philosophers of the 20th century, but what's so striking to me is he volunteered to go to the front lines of World War I. He went off to be a school teacher in rural Austria where everybody made fun of him. And he also knew the importance of silence and not saying too much. And that's in some ways, I can't follow his books of philosophy, but I can follow the examples of, he volunteered to work in a hospital too. Those kind of things I can follow and could even implement, though I would never begin to have his mind.
Well, since this is the top of the hour, as Kiki pointed out, I'm going to ask one of those awkward podcast questions, which is basically like, what has silence taught you? What have you learned from this ritual and how will you carry it forward?
It's changed the way I think of success, and therefore it's changed my whole life. Before I had some notion of having a presence in the world and writing books and decorating my resume that seemed like the important thing to do. And suddenly I saw none of that's very interesting or useful, and none of that's going to help me when I go into the ICU when my loved ones are sick. So what can I do that will help me in the ICU? And probably it's sitting quietly and gathering an inner savings account and inner resources that will help me in the moments of crisis that come to any life. So I really would have a very long answer to that question, but I would say that silence has taught me everything I never learned in my schools, and that's basically everything essential.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Pico Iyer's new book, A Flame, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.